This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Alex Taylor from the Online Wine Tasting Club. How are you, Alex?
I'm very good, thanks, Chris.
Excellent. The first time we tried this and the recording didn't quite work, I completely hashed it up and I was I was like, oh, this is terrible, but don't worry, I edited it out.
There you go. Smooth as a badger's back this time.
Absolutely perfect this time, so brilliant, brilliant. Last week we talked a wee bit about your online wine tasting club, where you came from, how you got where you are, and, and what you're doing. And we talked a wee bit about your bottling process and your pouches, etc. This week I want to explore the pouches in a lot more detail and just really understand some of the issues you've had with it, because there have been some technical issues and there's all sorts of stuff associated with them. So that's where I want to go with this week.
Sounds good.
Do you want to just tell us a little bit about what the pouches are? Just describe them
at a
high level.
Absolutely. So what comes into us is these reels of film, and the film is primarily aluminium. It's a solid layer of aluminium. So there's loads of different films out there. There's the films that your bag in box made out of, and there's things that plastic bags are made out of. And it's very easy to look and say, this looks the same. It's either shiny or it isn't.
You showed me one. They looked identical to me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they have completely different properties. It's absolutely mad. Like some of the most simple PE layer films are 500 times worse than a glass bottle with a cork at letting in oxygen. And, it goes all the way down to stuff which is designed to keep, medicine in tip-top condition for years and years. So it has to be absolutely pristine at keeping the oxygen out. So it's very easy to look at these things and conflate them and think, oh, that's plastic, or oh, that's whatever it is. And yeah, there's lots of things out there, so we've spent a lot of time evaluating the different options. But yeah, so ours is primarily aluminium. It has a very, very thin layer of plastic on the inside of it, which is, that's the part that melts. And so it, inside our machine, it's formed first into a tube, and then you get a big vertical seal going along the back of that. And then you form the bottom, and then we flush it out of all of the oxygen, all of the air, with some food safe nitrogen. It's got to be pristine, ultra clean nitrogen as well. The wine goes in and then it's heat sealed again, snipped off by the machine. And that happens every few seconds.
And it looks a bit like a tomato sauce sachet, but bigger, really,
yeah,
isn't it?
Absolutely. It's the same construction. There's loads of, as I've learned, more than I ever wanted to know about sachet construction. That's for sure. But there's strengths and advantages to all sorts of different structures of them. The way that we're doing it is really just designed to try to keep the oxygen out, and that's all it boils down to. So we're cutting out every bit of complexity, no spouts, which means it's a separate material to recycle and has to be all separated. So ours just goes straight into the aluminium recycling.
Okay. Oh, yeah, we'll talk about recycling towards the end, actually, because that's something I was quite interested about. You mentioned oxygen ingress.
Yeah.
And when we first, we bottle.
Of course, yeah.
And we found that the wines are pretty stable we rebottle into glass bottles, but it's got a plastic lid.
Yep.
And there is a little bit of oxygen gets in during the rebottling process. We know the wines are good for 2 to 3 weeks. You don't really notice any deviation. After about 3 weeks, you start to see a bit of a deviation. For us, it's not really an issue, because if we're doing a corporate event, we'll bottle it and ship it, and they'll drink it within 2, maybe 3 weeks, absolute max from bottling, and we know the wines are in good condition.
Yeah.
For courses like WSET Level 3, where it's a 6-week course, we know that the wines are deviated from the original style of wine, but only a little bit, and it's still representative of the style. But more importantly, the person they're tasting the wine with is tasting the same wine in the same condition, and therefore you're calibrating. That was the key thing, is really about calibration against their palate. So it's okay for us, but you guys, you were saying you've got wine that you keep for months and months.
Oh,
and
yeah,
months.
Absolutely. And we regularly go back and try wines we've packed, 6 months, 12 months ago, and see what's happened. Because, that's the thing. Wine is probably the most complicated of things to pack in the world. Like, if you're doing, when we spoke to people about all these different machines, there were ones we're doing yogurt sticks for kids, and that's got its own set of problems. If you get, a milk-based substance and that starts going off and you give it to your kid, you can kill them. It's there's so many different subtleties to these things, depending on what it is you're doing. But wine, you can't pasteurize it. because it'll get heat damaged. You can't filter it because you've got your winemaker who's decided that this is unfined, unfiltered, and that will just destroy the wine. And to be honest, you'd need to multi-stage filter it as well if you were going to do that. And you can't add things to it because if I were to add some preservatives that would stop any further damage, it will quite possibly take it over the legal limits for your total sulfites in there. Or it's just not representative. It's not what we want to be doing, to add anything to the wine or take anything away. It's got to be the same. And that is incredibly tough on levels that we just didn't realise at the start, because obviously we were doing glass bottling and we were doing it for events, and that was totally fine, just like you described, for things that are happening in the next few weeks. Really not a problem. It was when we started going out and shipping internationally or doing things that were, you know, going to be done in a month or two, that it was, there were real problems started to appear on a couple of wines. And it was a real kind of mystery investigation, trying to get to the bottom of what it was. And we worked with, you've spoken to Emma Rice at Hattingley. Yeah. She had her custom crush lab, yeah, which has now been absorbed into Hattingley. So they're our laboratory that we worked with doing sort of analysis on how the wine's evolved. What's the, you know, after 6 months, what's the level of free sulfites? How much did we destroy in the bottling process or the pouching process versus how much has gone over time? So but it was a real mystery when we started looking into some of the wines that had gone off. Because we had solved initially the oxygen problem. That was what the entire custom machine had been designed to do. You know, you're spending about $100,000 on a machine that is designed to keep the oxygen out at all stages from this. So, and we've got this aluminium film that has an unmeasurable level of oxygen that goes into it. So we were a bit, well, to be honest, we were scratching our heads going, what the hell has happened? And when you solve one problem, you quite often reveal other problems that just haven't had a chance to happen yet. It shouldn't have been a surprise to me, because, you know, I trained as a winemaker at Plumpton, and we obviously cover the bottling process, but it was so blindingly obvious to me. The wines that caused problem were ones where there was a bit of residual sugar in, and potentially a slightly higher pH for the acidity, and a lower alcohol level. So it was that kind of combination that was a mid-level.
Whites and Vendels.
Yeah. Marlborough Sauvignons, like some of the Italian whites, absolutely. And even some of the low-alcohol Rieslings as well, at sort of the, you know, the not into the super sweet neck of the woods. Cabinets. Yeah, it was the cabinet Rieslings, those kind of things where you were starting to run into problems. And when we started looking at the stuff under the microscope, obviously you use various dyes to try to identify what exactly is going on, and it just stood out like absolutely obvious. Why didn't we get this before? It's the yeast, because you've got in wine, there is the dreaded preservative of sulfites. It obviously gives us headaches and all sorts of things. No, it doesn't. Just kidding.
I'm pleased you said that.
he's about to walk straight out the door. Yeah. sulfites are a brilliant preservative to keep microbial activity down and to stop oxidation. So
malolactic, Brettanomyces.
You've got your volatile acidity formation from acetobacter, those kind of things that are going on. So there's any number of ways that can go on. If you've got incomplete mallow, then Enococcus can kick that going again. That develops a little bit of gas. It just leads to some nasty things in the middle before it gets your nice lactic acid. But even if it happens and it does go all the way to lactic acid, that's not the same wine. No. So it's not what we were trying to do. But the big problem was yeast, which doesn't really get affected by the level of free sulfites that you have. Yeast is a challenging problem. So for those wines which have got a little bit of residual sugar in, the bottling process is immensely important, and what they will do is they'll cold crash the wine to make the yeast go dormant, and then they will filter it through a sterile filter, which is, they call it a submicron filter, and that filters out anything that's bigger than a yeast cell, and that doesn't filter out any flavours, let's be absolutely clear. As Tony Milanovsky said, trying to filter a flavour molecule out with a submicron filter is a bit like trying to filter out a golf ball with something the size of the Channel Tunnel. It's going to go through. So you get rid of your yeast, and then it goes into a sterilised bottle that's been sterilised with boiling hot water, that you will keep an absolutely closed loop. So this bottle, which has been sterilised with boiling hot water, the next thing happens is the wine goes in and it's screw capped or corked, and that's it. There is never any contact with the air. And what a lot of people have come to associate with oxidation is more air contact. It's the other things you find in the air that is not just the oxygen. So, so the first pouches that we saw going off were an Italian wine, a Zibibbo from Sicily, that I think was about 10-11% alcohol and had quite a bit of residual sugar in. And sure, there enough, there were yeast multiplying and doing their thing and turning the sugar into alcohol, because that's what yeast does.
Yeah.
You know, and so we'd accidentally created a fantastic halfway done pet nat in a pouch, which I think is a world first. But what we wanted.
Did you find that the carbon dioxide byproduct was, could you see the
It was puffy. It was absolutely puffy, yeah. And yeah. So...
Because you would think that you can shake it and you can feel the shake. That would be a giveaway. That the
if the thing is inflated like a packet of peanuts on an aeroplane, then there's been a bit of gas expansion
inside. Exactly.
And that's probably carbon dioxide, and that's because of microbial activity that's been happening. And the problem with trying to stop a microbial activity is it's one thing doing it inside a closed bottle line, but our film comes on big reels. It gets unwound in the air, and then it goes over a whole bunch of rollers and over a shoulder, which forms it into this tube. We flush the oxygen out, and we put the wine in, and we close it. But that's exposed to the air, entire process there. So until the very end, where we flush the air out, it is exposed to the atmosphere. So I think it was Louis Pasteur who discovered, when he put his little Petri dish out, stuff was falling into it from the air, and atmospheric yeast is all around us, absolutely everywhere. And so it was one of those, we see what the problem is. And the moment you start trying to move up to the next level of cleanliness in these machines, it starts adding a lot of zeros onto the end of it. So your £100,000 machine starts heading up in sort of, you know, £2 million, and it becomes a really serious problem to solve. Plus, a lot of the machines which are designed to do this, they solve that problem, but they don't have any inert gas things, because that's not the kind of product they're sold. They're not trying to protect things with inert gas like food. They're trying to protect things like pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. And so, again, it just leads you into this horrible world where there are no products available for you to buy, and so everything has to be custom built for you. So, it's a real challenge.
So how did you solve the problem, or have you not solved it?
The best way to say it is that we are in the process of solving it to a certain degree now. So we have moved our entire, the open part of the production, from the moment that hermetic seal of the cork or the screw cap is broken and you open it up, we've moved that inside a clean room now. So, it vastly, vastly reduces the amount of atmospheric yeast. It doesn't get it down to zero, but it's a very low chance that anything could go wrong. And we've increased the sterilization of our film as it goes through just before it makes the pouch. We now have ultraviolet lights that blast the surface. The next generation machine is a specific pharmaceutical grade machine, and that takes that to the next level of it's just ramping it up and making sure that it's a cleaner environment but in a smaller area.
Yep.
So only the bit where the film's exposed is now super, super clean. And it also has a thing called a clean in place procedure, which basically blasts through 80 degrees Celsius water through any part that comes into any contact with the wine, to kill things between runs, because that was another big problem, was cross-contamination between wines. What we thought was doing a good enough cleaning job might leave a couple of cells behind, and then that contaminates the next wine, not with flavors but potentially with those dormant yeast. So
how secure is your current solution with, say, a white Zinfandel, which is your classic nightmare wine?
So we're about to find out, is the answer. So it's certainly massively improved from where it was. We packed up some Cabernet Riesling about 8 months ago, and we went back to it today, and it's still absolutely perfect. And we were, to be honest, surprised, because that was done before we did the clean room. So just process improvements, small little adjustments, and learning about what chemicals to use to clean when and how often have been a big step forward. But We're now working with the Camden BRI laboratory to do accelerated life testing. So you can do with that, they basically ramp it up and down on temperature, just like being in a porch for while the person's away on holiday, but in a more controlled fashion. And in 15 days, they can simulate 6 months of sitting on a shelf. And in 30 days, they can simulate a year. So we're sending off some of those super fragile wines, and we'll get the results back very soon. But the key thing is that we are really confident that when we get our next generation machine, which is, like we said, a really serious expenditure, and we're just raising a bit of money to do that now, that should give us the 12 month shelf life at room temperature, even on the most problematic wines, which will undoubtedly reveal the next set of problems.
I was going to say, so once you solve yeast, what is the next problem?
There's any number of different problems that could expose themselves. So in one part of it, when you're dealing with on the very inside layer of our aluminium film, there is a tiny layer of plastic, which is what does the sealing. If you look at canned wines, they have this conformal layer, a coating just inside, which is generally sprayed on. And what a bunch of testing has found is that if there's any small breaches in that, you can get hydrogen sulfide formation, particularly if you've done various things in the vineyard with copper usage, or if you've done copper fining. But yeah, there's some situations where you can start getting those reductive characters, especially as you've excluded perhaps too much oxygen. So that's one of the big areas to look at. And the other area as well, which we're aware of and are being very careful about, is the possibility of any scalping. And wine is, as we've said, a really complicated, difficult substance to pack. But the different flavour molecules that go into this, they will often have a charge associated with them. So when you've got a film running through a machine, it will be shedding electrons and developing a charge on the surface of the film. So you can get an attraction between the film and some of those flavours. So you could potentially get a small amount of scalping. It's amplified by doing a small portion. Everything is made harder by doing a small portion.
Just on that scalping, because scalping is something we don't talk about much on the show, but the classic example of it is, if you ever get a corked wine...
Yeah.
Put it into a big bowl, put some cling film in there, stir it up. The cork taint will cling to the cling film. It'll also strip the wine of flavour.
It will.
But if you come home from the pub at 1 a.m. and you want a glass of wine and the only bottle is a cork wine, this is what you do to solve the problem. You scalp out the cork taint.
That's a top tip there.
Yeah, it is a top tip, mate. for the desperate.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, a lot of people talk about scalping, for example, corks scalp. And we're just so used to the fact that cork scalps a wine that we just sort of accept that the wine with a cork is what it's supposed to taste like. But in actual fact, the cork still scalps flavours from the wines as well.
There is no perfect solution in the world, unfortunately. And I've been listening to your podcast when you were talking to When in Rome, and everything is about trade-offs. Everything in the real world is about trade-offs. And it's deeply frustrating that fewer people don't understand this, that while you're solving a massive problem, you might be introducing another smaller problem, and that doesn't invalidate your approach. Like, if it's slightly harder to recycle your bag-in-box interior, okay, but you've got to weigh that up somehow against what you've saved and what you've won. What you've got to balance the wins against the losses and see what it is.
You mentioned reduction in the wines, and one of the things that you were worried about was obviously corks let in oxygen into the wine, which means that once you go into a pouch, that oxygen ingress isn't going to happen.
Yep.
And some wines, particularly if they've used a lot of sulfur dioxide, can go into reductive characteristics. State. So you get these red wines that they go, oh, this wine won't age for 20 years.
Yeah.
Partly because they've stuck in so much sulfur dioxide, which helps with the aging process. But then you're putting it into a no-oxygen environment.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you're getting a wine that will start to develop. How would you describe reduction? I normally use cauliflower, vegetables.
Yeah, I mean, it's suddenly heading into almost the rotten egg kind of characteristics, isn't it? It's in a subtle way, and you know, but yeah, the cauliflowery kind of thing. And it's funny because you can let it blow off for a bit, and it will generally speaking, fix itself. I screwed up on the wines I made myself. I'd seen winemakers sprinkling sulfites over the grapes at the time of crushing,
yeah,
to try to stop the oxidation happening on. I clearly put far too much on that. When I went back to it, it had developed the most astonishing hydrogen sulfide-y kind of smell to it. And you can fine it with copper sulfate to reduce that.
Copper sulfate takes it. Yeah. So if you get a stinky wine, as you say.
Yeah,
you
go to your kid's chemistry kit. No, don't do that.
No. No, in the old days, you just get a piece of copper and stick it in there. You know, if you've got a bit of copper pipe lying around.
Of course, yeah.
That'll work.
That's cool.
But you're right. Sometimes the sulfur flavors will burn off. Sometimes if you get a little bit of a stinky New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, you just let it breathe. It'll go away. But if they go through to McCaptan's, which is where they get really stuck, and then they won't burn off. That's it. You're all over.
Yeah. So I think you've got to. I mean, obviously, we'd love to give people a taste of some of these wines, like, you know, the Barolos and things that are really expensive. And that's one of the great things about having got this process to the point where it is being so careful and so protected, the wine, that we've blind tasted masters of wine side by side with pouch and bottle, things that have been in the pouch for months and the bottle, and they are not able to tell the difference. So we're really confident that we've got this in an absolutely brilliant place. But it's not designed for aging 20 years. That's not what this is. It's horses for courses. It is quite clearly, this is a way to let you try a wine, not to let you age it and then have a single glass of it in 20 years. And whether we could do that or not. So you can then take a sort of a trade-off position. And I was talking to a couple of people on Twitter. I love wine Twitter. Is both brilliant and terrible at the same time, isn't it? You know.
Well, I don't know. I don't do Twitter.
Stay well away from it.
That's what Jane's job is. Yeah. Jane's a Twitterer.
When people aren't being really rude to each other about the most insignificant things, you have direct access to this incredible range of knowledge that's there. And so I was chatting to Brad Grouchix from Nightimber, and I was saying, like, he's talking about the different level of oxygen transfer rate that you pick for the corks and how you do it for the wine. I said, are there any kind of tests that you do? What are we looking for in the wine to is there a direct link between something in the wine and the oxygen transfer rate you want for ideal aging over a certain time frame? And the answer was basically a lot of experience. So slightly unhelpfully, lots of experience and learning what.
That Emma Rice from Hettingley was talking about the relationship between acidity levels and sulfur dioxide as being...
Oh, for sure. That definitely comes into it. But in terms of there's particularly for things like, you know, stuff with a load of polyphenols in, and if you're getting under the polymerization that goes on and the tannins, that requires a bit of oxygen. Yeah. So the almost like the more kind of skin contact you have, the more oxygen you know you're going to need. The bigger, the thicker skin varieties, the more oxygen you're going to need. And so it is kind of along those lines of there is a relationship for sure, but it's I don't think anyone's got the sort of the formula to make it a nice, easy calculation. But there's you know, there's some great wines in cans now, and I think, you know, you look at Cop Crew Canned Wine Company doing really top quality wines in cans, and the real challenge is the red wines, because of course they've got the colour, they've got the tannins, they've got those polyphenols that are going on, and you know, if there's no oxygen in that can, they're going to be the ones that tend towards the more reductive characteristics and don't just taste how you'd expect when you open it up. So, and their approach for that was controlled oxygenation through the canning process will help shift something in the direction of oxidative, but it's now going to then shift back so that maybe in 12 months' time, it's exactly where... you know, where you'd hope it would be in maybe 3 years' time, and so it's in a really good place. And then maybe in 2 years, it's gone too far again.
So how are you going to solve the problem of this oxidation? You know, have you got a plan for it?
Well, I think the first thing is we need to work out how much of a problem there actually is, because you know, it's a funny one. We're aware of a lot of these problems in theory, because what we didn't want to do is to be tricked again. When you're going to spend millions of pounds on a new production line, you want to have thought through every eventuality and make sure that is a big part of it is going to be trying to
can you just
charge.
Get a £1,000 kit from China, that would be all you need.
we could do that again. It's always very tempting. I did the same with a label sticking machine again, and it's absolutely fine as long as you don't want the sticker in the same place each time. And talk to any winemaker, labeling machines are the bane of their lives, and bottling lines as well. But yeah, it's certainly, I think we've got a few ideas on that front, both on the scalping and on the oxygenation issue, how to do it. We were thinking through whether we need different films for it. We were thinking through whether we want to sort of potentially do micro perforations in the films. There's lots of different approaches we can take, and each comes with their own set of trade-offs, as always, unfortunately. But but we just want to make sure we're at the cutting edge of this, and then we want to prove it and to challenge that kind of concept that we've heard it from a lot of winemakers who've done these small bottling things, and they are really worried. They don't want to do this anymore. They don't want to do the sampling. They have tried it with a whole bunch of different people all around the world, and by the time it's reached their customers, who are trying to judge it not on a sort of an education event or a tasting event, that this is deciding which wines they're going to have in their shop or restaurant, and they want it to be representative. So we need to have that kind of conversation, an open conversation about what these problems are and how, you know, some of the things which look exactly the same can perform completely differently, depending on, it's all about the process, not just the actual package itself. So loads of people said, can you send us some of your pouches? And I said, it's not like that. I'd have to send you my factory, and we'd love to set up ones in other countries.
I thought you had a £1,000 factory you could send them.
I can send them something as long as they just don't care about their customers. But yeah, it's going to be a gradual process to sort of get this out around the world, because you the carbon savings of what we do are off the charts. I mean, we talk about the end-to-end 15-time saving. That's when we're getting the glass bottles coming to us. If you look at just the packaging material itself, glass is about 8.4 kilograms of carbon dioxide for every kilo of glass you produce. So if you've got a particularly heavy glass bottle, you could be like sort of 6 kilos of or even 8 kilos of carbon dioxide just in the manufacturing, and then there's shipping it, and then there's recycling. And recycling, it's pretty much, you know, it's not far off the same amount of energy, because you have to heat it up to an immense temperature. So for a 6 glass bottle tasting pack, when each glass sample tube for 100 ml probably is about 1.4 kilograms of carbon dioxide. And you're thinking about that. For 100 ml of wine, I'm putting a 1.5 kilos of carbon dioxide into the air. And that is absolutely bonkers. And aluminium is 0.5 kilo per kilo, and we've got 2.5 grams. So it's 1.2 grams of carbon dioxide versus 1.5 kilograms of carbon dioxide. It's 1,000 times better.
Once you get this new bottling line, maybe you could go international with the product, effectively providing that service in different countries. You could ship from here, but then you're shipping into UK and then shipping out again,
lots of customs problems and all those kind of things start adding up. But also, it's not a green solution if an Australian winery ships their wine to the UK and we ship back a bunch of pouches. Go, hey, look, it's that much lower carbon. But we've just shipped it twice around the world.
But also the location of the bottling plant. If you think about it, if you were, say, getting close, if you were in Bristol near Accolade's big bottling production, where they're just bringing in containers of bag and container, effectively it's not bag and box,
it's bag and container.
And then they bottle it into the glass bottles, but you could take it from there and then bottle it straight in, and then your carbon footprint goes through the floorboards completely.
But equally, it's in a container, so get it onto a lorry, get it over to us, and the like you've said many times, the cost per bottle of shipping that container is really nothing, you know, especially on ship. But by the time it goes into glass bottles, becomes, you know, a fraction of the density in terms of the wine per lorry. It's massive. So we would love people to be getting to the point where people are shipping bulk containers, whether it's big bag in boxes or whether it's a 1,000 liter IBC, those kind of things. That would be great.
Cool. All right, then. I think we're going to wrap it up there, Alex.
Thanks so much.
Cheers very much.